Hello there, welcome to the latest Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. This week's guest is a digital entrepreneur and diversity advocate, driving innovation and transforming business culture. Sarah Wood, OBE, co-founded Unruly back in 2006. She grew it from an idea charting the popularity of viral videos to a global online advertising business, selling to News Corp for $114 million 9 years later. Sarah is on the board of Tech Nation, the growth platform for ambitious British tech entrepreneurs, is an ambassador for the Prince's Trust Women Supporting Women programme, and has won many accolades. And drawing on her time as CEO and founder of Unruly, Sarah wrote the career handbook Stepping Up, How to Accelerate Your Leadership Potential. Sarah, it really is fantastic to have you with us today. I feel there's just so much to talk about, and in some ways it's difficult to know where to start. So I'm going to cop out with a really difficult question for you. Tell us your story.
Oh, Helen, it's lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I never know where to begin with a story. The northeast of England is where it began. And that's where I was born and brought up for the first 10 years of my life. My dad's a trade unionist. My mum was a playgroup supervisor and then a shop assistant. Wonderful parents always instilled in me the importance of a strong work ethic, strong principles. And they were a real activist couple as well. They were very involved in politics. They were involved in helping have an impact on people's lives and making the world around them a better place. So I guess right from the start, that had been a big source of inspiration for me and just what I'd known. We moved down to Brighton when I was 10, and that was very different, a lot warmer for a start, which I really enjoyed, and a lot less windy, also very nice. And from there, I went through school. I went to the local comprehensive school and loved all my subjects, really. Loved learning. I didn't have that many friends, if I'm being honest, because it wasn't the kind of school where kids who worked really hard and loved learning were the most popular kids, but I absolutely loved it. And the teachers were fantastic, gave me lots of support, and went off from there, had a gap year. And I think that was the first point that I realized I didn't know exactly what my next steps were going to be. And I just started experimenting. And all the way through school, everyone says, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I think every time someone asked me, I must have had a different answer. I was almost certainly going to be prime minister, first female bishop. I was going to be the editor of magazines, newspapers. You know, I had a very busy life planned, definitely a head teacher at some point. So many ideas, but then very little experience. So I just kind of got on with getting some experience and trying lots of different things.
I was curious to know where you grew up in the northeast, because I'm from the northeast.
So I was born in Ashington Hospital and grew up in Seaton Sluice, which is a little village in between Whitley Bay and Blyth.
I know Seaton Sluice. I've got friends there, actually. I'm a Grimsby girl. So how was it that your gap year, you know, what sort of influence did your gap year have on helping you sort of decide which direction you were going to go in at that stage of your life?
It was a year of many different opportunities. So I started off in New York working at a camp with homeless children. And every fortnight, the buses would go into the Bronx, to Harlem, to Queens, pick up coachloads of kids who were living in hostels with parents and who were really struggling. And then we'd bring them out into the kind of the wilds of upstate New York, Bear Mountain it was called. And the camp was called Camp Homeward Bound. And it was just a fabulous place. And the kids had so much fun, and they swam and they ran and they mucked around, and we had campfires and we put on plays. We just had a really good laugh, and that was an incredible experience and just so much fun to be with teams of people who were all kind of focused on this mission of making sure that those kids had a good time. Then I came back. I worked in Benetton clothes shop for a little while, which wasn't
me. I remember
me.
Benetton.
You know, I'm not very good at folding. Folding is not my thing, and nor is
folding
putting clothes
and colour
on coat
coordination,
hangers.
Huh? Yeah, no, that's not my forte either.
So anyway, it was great. I did that for a few weeks. And then I was very involved with the church at the time and went off to Uruguay, where the church had a kind of volunteering outpost, a monastery. And I lived in the monastery for a few months with the monks and worked at local hospitals, hospices, children's homes, soup kitchens. Really enjoyed it. Difficult experience, but I love languages. So for me personally, it was so exciting to be able to learn to speak Spanish and live a life being able to speak Spanish. And again, just be part of so many different worlds. Really fun. And then I came back because there was a general election and I wanted to be part of the campaign. So I worked with the Labour Party at that point, campaigning, leafleting, you know, nothing glamorous, just the legwork. I've always not minded legwork. And that was a lot of fun. And then I worked on Brighton Pier for the rest of the year. Pancakes, ice creams, donuts, fish and chips, hot dogs, you name it, I've manned the stand.
Did being in places like New York with homeless youngsters and being in Uruguay give you that real sense that you wanted longer term to make a difference in life?
I just enjoyed it so much. So I think at the time, I'm not sure how much it made me think about career choices, but you just know when you're doing something that's meaningful. And what I understood was that whatever I did, it needed to be meaningful and I needed to be able to throw myself into it. And I think that's probably always been part of my nature. When I was doing my first job when I was 12 and I was egg packing in a factory, also not a great job for me because I'm quite clumsy. But, you know, I was throwing myself into it, throwing the eggs around, really getting into it. But whether it was dog walking or whether it was working at the local Wimpy bar, working at the shoe shop, you know, all those different jobs that I tried, if I enjoyed something and I knew what I had to do and I knew what the job for the day was, then I generally felt really happy, satisfied, and came home with that wonderful feeling, you know, the satisfaction of a job well done. And I've always been a big believer in that. You know, that feeling of tiredness you get when you've done a good day's work and you know you're moving things in the right direction. Of course, when you're 14 or 15, moving things in the right direction is saving up enough money to be able to buy Christmas presents. You know, it's not big things necessarily. But even so, it doesn't have to be the, you know, the grandest, most selfless, world-changing mission. Just feeling that you're going in the right direction and being yourself when you're doing it is very rewarding.
You went to Cambridge University. What led you down the academia route, which is the route you went down before Unruly, isn't it?
I nearly didn't go to Cambridge because I wasn't sure it was for me. And no one from my school had been before. No one from my family had been to university. So it seemed like a really big step at the time. But the school were so encouraging. And this is part of the reason the school was so brilliant for me. They really were there for me. And their head took me to the college to have a look around. And my mum and dad were also very encouraging. I remember my dad saying, look, you have to decide, do you want to be a big fish in a small pond? Or are you going to kind of go and find a bigger pond? And I thought, well, maybe I should find a bigger pond. So I did go. Went to King's College, which was brilliant college for me. It was quite left-leaning, a bit more diverse than some of the other colleges, and you know, lots of lovely people. And that's where I met friends for life and my husband, who was there at the same time. I was studying English. He was studying philosophy. And why did we go into academia? He also started doing a PhD. Well, because we didn't know what else to do. We didn't have much guidance. We didn't really have a clue, if I'm being honest. And we could see that there were some people who seemed to be on a route and they had a clear direction and they knew where they were going and they were getting internships and they were working with various law firms or engineering companies over the summer and then going off and being part of a thing called the Milk Round. And I was like, oh, Milk Round, being a milkman. Yeah, I could do that. We didn't necessarily understand what was going on around us all the time. You're a teenager, you don't always know what's going on around you. I certainly didn't. But there was a clear route with academia. And because I enjoyed my studies so much and I loved American literature, so doing a master's was really sensible. But I didn't do it straight away. I actually came down to London and worked in a CAF for a few months, probably the most overqualified CAF worker. And then I joined London Underground, worked for London Underground for a little while. We set up a tutoring agency together, tutored loads of kids and refugees who were coming in that time to London as well. So we were able to do some really good kind of English language tutoring that hopefully was really helpful for people who were just learning to get to grips with the culture and the language. Another gap year, just like my whole life has been like one gap year after the next, just trying these different things. And at the end of that, I came back to doing the master's, which was back in Cambridge and wonderful because I love the subject, but a very difficult year because my mum and dad were splitting up. And I don't think it matters what age you are. If your parents break up, it absolutely breaks your heart and it tears you apart and it confuses you. And, you know, all the kind of the foundations and the cornerstones upon which your life has been built kind of come tumbling down. So it was a difficult year, but definitely worth doing.
You sound like you've packed so much in. Everything you've done with such verve and enthusiasm and joy, really. But it was 7/7, wasn't it? The terrorist attacks in July the 7th, which I reported on live for Channel 5, actually, that really seemed to have changed the course of your life. Can you share with us, Sarah, what happened on that day?
Yeah, that was a day when the world around me changed and the world just felt like it had been turned upside down. And at that point, I was lecturing in Sussex. So I'd completed a PhD, was working in Sussex, teaching down there, and I had two kids. One was at school, one was at nursery. And every day was a juggle. And I know your listeners are so gonna, you know, they're all going through it. Every day is a juggle. Every day you just about get through it. Some days you don't. Some days you send your kids to school in pajamas. And this was a day when things didn't go quite to plan and we were late. And I remember going down to the tube station and it was down in Mile End. So coming from Hackney down to Mile End with a couple of other mums, the three of us were all kind of cursing ourselves, going, I can't believe we're late again. How has this happened? We went down to the platform. And as we were on the platform, we just heard coming up through the tunnels, a couple of miles further down the line. So nothing too close by, but you can hear it. You could hear the noise, you could hear the banging, you could hear the chaos. And then immediately the station was evacuated and we all kind of went up to the top. Of course, we didn't exactly know what happened. And I remember walking back home and seeing the helicopters all above and thinking, what is going on? And turning on the TV when I got back and seeing it. And it was just one of those moments where you take stock. More than 50 people didn't come home that morning and it was their last journey. And if we hadn't been late, and if I hadn't have been late, then I would have been a lot closer to King's Cross where I was heading for. And you just think, oh, near miss. And it just does make you take stock. And I think the only positive thing to come out of those moments is to take the moment to reflect. And at that time I did, and I just thought, is this the life I want? Do I want to be commuting every week down to Sussex, saying goodbye to my children on Tuesday, heartbroken, and that's not seeing them again till Thursday? And it just felt like the moment for a change. And it's only sometimes when you have a big shock that change feels possible, because everything is changing around you. And I think COVID's quite similar. I've seen so many people who have hummed and hawed and worried over decisions for years. And as the world changes around you with something like COVID as well, suddenly anything is possible. And you think, well, why not? Now's the moment. Everything else is changing. Everyone else is changing. Whether it's for better or for worse, it's a time to make a change. And for years, Scott and I had been talking about doing something together. And Scott's my husband. And we just really enjoy working together. He's super smart and really fun to work with. We've noodled on lots of different ideas. But that was the catalyst. And that was the day that I decided, right, I'm going to hand in my resignation and let's do something new. Let's start a business because we can do it together. We can take control. We can do it in our own time. And it will be for us and for the family.
It's funny you should say that. We met somebody this week, actually, who's worked in the corporate arena for 20 years, 14-hour days, 6 days a week, who said that during lockdown, she'd had complete reassessment of her life and she was heading off in her 50s on a gap year and giving up the corporate life. So I think you're right. There are certain crossroads in your life and sometimes that crossroad does come out of something quite shocking and unexpected. And thank goodness you were late that day and that for you and your family, it was an okay outcome. But what sort of gave you that idea for Unruly? Is Unruly something you'd sort of been noodling with, even though it probably didn't have a name in the noodling stage?
Well, you're right, it didn't have a name. And our poor neighbours, we were kind of always going round to their flats. And we had a really close-knit community and we would be knocking on each other's doors, normally with kids asking for childcare. But we would knock on people's doors with cards with prospective names for businesses. We'd be saying, what do you think about this and this and this and this? We didn't really know what we wanted to do to begin with. We had all kinds of fun. And I think that's often what it's like when you come up with business ideas. You have to think of so many ideas and generate so many ideas before maybe the idea comes along. We set up the business knowing that we wanted to do something in Web 2.0 because that was the thing back then. And it was a really exciting moment. It's not dissimilar structurally to where we are right now in terms of the size of the opportunity and the new tech arenas that are taking shape. Back then in 2006, it was all social and it was really exciting. It was the democratization of the internet. So rather than just being talked at by broadcasters or businesses, people trying to sell you things or give you directions, suddenly everybody was talking and the blogosphere had exploded and there were people were commenting on posts. They were starting to upload their own content, starting to upload their own videos, their own jokes, their own photos. And that just felt really exciting. And we could see it was the beginning of a system change. We didn't know what we wanted to do, but we knew that we wanted to be part of it.
So you saw this opportunity. What was Unruly? What did it start out as and what inspired you?
Well, it started out as myself Scott and Matt, so the three co-founders, and Matt was our CTO, brilliant CTO, knowing that we wanted to build something that would harness the power of Web 2.0. And we didn't know where to start, but we knew we had to start with something. So we built a little website called eatmyhamster.com. It's really daft. But it was a comedy website and it was a social website. So it was a site where you could come on, you could upload your own jokes, your own funny photos, funny jokes, funny videos, and you could upvote the others. It was, there was a big site, a dig as the site. It was huge at the time, but it didn't have a comedy section. It was much more techie. So we thought, well, wouldn't it be great if there was a space just like Dig, but instead of it all being kind of geeky and serious, it would just be fun. It'd be somewhere where you'd come and have a laugh. So we built it and nobody came apart from like our parents, you know, some friends. And we, you know, there were a couple of people who stopped by, but it wasn't huge. And what we realized very quickly from that was we learned that first of all, people love video, and the video content was the content, even back in 2006, so pre-broadband, when it's really hard to, you know, watch video, even back then we could see video was engaging people. And we also realized it was hard to find what was trending because already there was so much content and it was hard to navigate. So with that learning, we killed the hamster.
Poor hamster.
And we brutally killed after 2 to 3 months and started building something called Viral Video Chart. And it was a spider. It crawled the web, crawled the blogosphere, because that's where everybody was sharing at the time. This is pre-Twitter. Facebook was still private. It was all very kind of early days. Crawled the blogosphere, recognized video URLs, aggregated all those URLs, and then ranked them in order of popularity. So it was the first site to be able to show people what were the most shared videos, otherwise known as the most viral videos. And that was very different. That was an instant hit in terms of people loving the site and loving the content. And we had a partnership with The Guardian very quickly. They loved the data as well, and their readers were just getting interested in ideas of viral video. But we still didn't have a business model. So we had a great site that was culturally relevant and interesting and very enjoyable to run, but we didn't have the business. And that took a little bit longer. So more experimentation, more ideas. We tried little native advertising widgets on the side of the page. 2 weeks and 30 pence later, we realized that this wasn't the business model either. But what we could see was that there were lots of publishers who together would bring scale. So we decided that a better business opportunity was to aggregate all the publishers, set up an advertising platform and connect the publishers with the brands and the branded video content. Because this is also the time when brands were just starting to get interested in creating digital video content. Up until then, it had all been just banner ads online and the video was still happening on TV. So it's such an interesting moment in media history as advertising started moving across to the internet because people were moving across to watching video online. And the opportunity of viral was, well, you can imagine what it was like for advertisers. It was so enticing because the promise was if you got it right, you could get millions, tens of millions of free views because people would be sharing your content and people would be watching your content at no cost to the advertiser. So for advertisers, they loved it. And it was an exciting platform that evolved and pivoted constantly over the, you know, the next 10 years. But that was the nub of it. So yeah, a video advertising platform.
Isn't it amazing to think that that was 2006? And when we look where we are now, you know, that was 2006. Advertisers were just looking at that online advertising, and yet it's come on so far and so quickly. Were you very techie at this stage, Sarah?
Oh, gosh,
or
no.
Not really?
No, not
or was
at
this
all.
A massive learning curve for you?
It was a huge learning curve, and it was a learning curve on every front. So if you think we'd set up an ad tech business, so advertising technology business, and I didn't know anything about advertising, just wasn't my field, didn't know anything about technology, didn't even think that business was an option. It wasn't something that careers advisors had talked about at all when I was growing up. It just didn't seem like a thing. So none of these three areas were areas of expertise, but that doesn't have to hold you back. If you've got great co-founders, this is my biggest learning from the Unruly journey, was you want to be working with brilliant people. People that will challenge you, people who will support you, and people who you enjoy being on the journey with. Matt obviously was a techie, so he was brilliant there because he could start building out our tech platform. And then Scott was a brilliant business brain. He had really kind of great vision in terms of where the industry was going and putting together business models and corporate structures. And I really enjoyed the content and really enjoyed thinking about why people were watching ads and what was it about these ads that made them go viral and how could brands harness that information to make better ads that people really wanted to watch and share, ads that people loved, ads that were great films, like fantastic content. So for me, it was a huge learning curve on all fronts, but there was an element in there where I felt really comfortable. And that was kind of analyzing the video content, which isn't so different from being academic. And as our business evolved, we became known for our analytics and our data and our predictive tools. So we were able to start predicting which videos would have the most success and why. And it turns out that emotional resonance, emotional impact is the key to virality. So the stronger the emotional impact, the more likely a piece of content is to go viral. Of course, there's lots that sits around that. Social amplifiers, time of day, is it somebody's passion? Does it tap into a zeitgeist that's already there? A little bit of luck. There's all kinds of things around the edge, but ultimately you need a piece of content that makes people laugh out loud or the hairs on the back of their neck rise up or the tears pour down their face. And that's always what we were aiming for as we grew the business.
I think one of your craziest days is when you flash mobbed Tech City. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, that's so true. Flash mobs were a thing at the time. So quite a few of the videos we were starting to see coming through were flash mob videos. And though it was a wonderful phenomenon, you don't see them so much anymore now. But I just loved those years when you'd be walking down the street and suddenly a bunch of people would start dancing. And we were sat in our office in the Truman Brewery on Brick Lane. And suddenly we saw lots of activity happening across the road in the big hall. And I talked to the estates manager. I said, what's going on over there? He said, oh, there's a big tech do. You know, they're launching Tech City. It's all the tech companies and the PM's going to be here and everyone who's anyone in tech. And I said, but we're a technology company. We live here and we don't know about it. And then I just thought, well, this surely is an opportunity, but clearly we didn't have an invitation. We weren't very big at the time. We didn't have any money, but there was about 20 of us and we had cushions. We'd had social media cushions made up with all the kind of big social brands were on these cushions. So we decided to go downstairs and have a silent flash mob. So we stood in a long row opposite the entrance to the event and everybody stood with cushions over their faces. And half the people thought that we were sponsoring the event. It was on ITN, it was on all BBC, it was on all the news channels. It's been a big launch of Tech City. And then the other half of the people, including David Cameron's security team, thought we were picketing the event and that we were clearly trouble. Especially when we're holding up cushions that say unruly. It's not what the police want to see. But it was just really fun. And it was the best half hour of networking I think I've done in my entire life. I stood by the exit and as everybody came out, I just handed out unruly business cards. And that really put us on the map. So now it's wonderful because I love being on the board of Tech Nation and having watched Tech Nation from the very beginning of the journey.
I'm going to ask you about the board of Tech Nation in a minute because I'm sure you're excited by how many young, talented British tech entrepreneurs there are. But just a final sort of unruly question is, you started off with a hamster and an idea. And 9 years later, I love saying that you sold for 140 million just because it just says to me that anybody can really do that if you've got the passion and drive. Did you ever expect it, Sarah, to take off in such an extraordinary way and that 9 years later you'd be selling for that kind of money?
I think there were moments along the way, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs are a bit like this, you have an irrational optimism. So yes, there were moments when I absolutely thought that would be our outcome and I couldn't understand why it was taking 9 years. But there were equally moments when I thought it's all going to be over tomorrow. And it always felt like a roller coaster. Never stopped feeling like we were on a precipice. It didn't matter how big the business grew. It was a competitive sector. It still is. Google, Facebook, all these big tech giants competing for ad dollars. And we've seen, you know, in that period, Facebook and Google taking the lion's share now of digital advertising. So it was a tough market. And I was just flip-flop constantly from the high and the low. One moment I'd be thinking, we can do this, we can take on Facebook and win. And then the next day I would just have my head in my hands in despair, thinking that's it, we're done. And that's where actually managing my own mental health became a really important part of surviving and thriving, because they are hard years, But if you've got brilliant people around you, and if you take the time to enjoy the people that are around you and have a good time together, then that in itself is really helpful. I think it was helpful being in the business of emotional intelligence, and our ad technology talked about emotional intelligence. But actually, one of my biggest journeys as a leader at Unruly was thinking about emotional intelligence and getting better at regulating my emotions and not being so up and down, because I could see that had a real effect on the team. It must have been very difficult to work for and work with a lot of the time for that very reason.
So how did you manage to manage your mental health and manage those ups and downs and bring perhaps a calmer, sort of more even temperament to that?
You'll probably gather from our conversation that the calmer, even temperament hasn't ever really evolved as well as it could have done.
I think that's a good thing, Sarah. I think that you've got so much energy. It's fantastic.
But there were some good hacks. Through that period, there were only hacks. There was no philosophy behind it. There was no kind of long-term thinking about it. There were just, what are the quick, small things that I can do to make sure that I'm not causing damage and that I'm motivating these brilliant people rather than demotivating them? So one thing I used to do a lot of was when I walked through a door, I would take a deep breath and start again. And I'd always make sure that I was smiling and I was ready for the room and I wouldn't be carrying with me any difficult conversations or difficult thoughts. So opening the door was always a new start. And in one of our offices, we had a lot of doors. So I was constantly opening doors and that was really helpful. And then the other thing is thinking about every single person in the business as a person. So every time I would go into a meeting, and I had loads of one-ones, I love spending time with the team and making sure that we were aligned and that we were going in the right direction and they knew what they were doing this week and they knew what that meant for the business and they knew where we were shooting for. But every time I went into the room, I would just remember that the person I was talking to, yes, they were unruly, but they also had a family. And there would be things that they were worried about. There'd be things they were excited about. And there might be some really bad things happening in their life at the moment. Sometimes we'd know about them, sometimes we wouldn't. So just taking the time to talk to them as a person, and that always kind of set the mood. And I found that really helpful because it just put things in perspective. It took me out of the worries of the business and reminded me that actually the business wasn't the be-all and end-all. There were a lot of people in the business and they were the be-all and end-all.
And did you also manage to find that balance in your personal life? Because you talked about, you know, being pretty heartbroken at leaving your kids on a Tuesday to go down to Sussex and coming back on a Thursday. But here you are with a startup company, a very dynamic company, taking a lot of your attention. Did you feel you got the balance right with the children and home life too? Because also you were working with your husband as well.
You never get it perfect. And you only find out when it's not perfect, when things start going wrong. So I would say that I push the boundaries. But hopefully when I pushed the boundaries and crossed the boundaries, I realised. So there were a couple of moments. We didn't have any help at home for the first few years. We had to sell our flat. We were really hard up trying to manage everything. And we probably did that for a bit too long. So I did once got a flight from New York. And the first phone call I had was from the school, from the primary school. And I think it was the head or one of the teachers there. And they said, oh, is everything all right, Sarah? I said, well, the fact that you're calling me probably means that everything isn't all right. She said, oh, it's just that, you know, your daughter brought the others into school today and she was in her pajamas. And I was thinking, oh, crikey. I said, oh, I'm really sorry. That wasn't supposed to happen. And we just had a childcare mess up. The lovely godparents who'd been staying overnight to look after the kids had gone off to work. And then the kids had been left by accident because I hadn't quite timed everything brilliantly. I'd given people the wrong instructions and the wrong information and things just hadn't worked out as I'd thought.
Do you know what? We all drop balls though, don't we sometimes?
We do, and I try not to beat myself up about it. But there are those moments I think, ooh, that's not good. There was a time when my eldest Lola Rose also got locked in the office one night and we didn't realise until the security guard was locking up about 10 o'clock. And she called me and she said, Mummy, I'm in the library. And I said, Oh, are you? And she said, yeah, but no one seems to be here. And I wasn't there. I was at an event and Scott was at another event. We just kind of left her there. So there were moments when things kind of went wrong. But for the most part, the kids loved it. And the benefit of being an entrepreneur is you can bring your family with you. And we try to encourage this with all the staff. bring the kids in. If it's half term, bring them in. If you've got a dog and you don't like leaving the dog at home, bring it in. And actually, a little bit of chaos doesn't do much harm. A little bit of chaos just helps everybody remember that this isn't rocket science. It's advertising. And we're doing a great job. We're doing our best job. But let's not forget why we're here. We're also here to support our families, and let's not leave them behind.
What you're saying about entrepreneurship is music to my ears, because finally, I'm scratching that entrepreneurial itch and have just started a new business with two fantastic people. And anyone can do it, can't they, Sarah, with passion and drive and good team. It's all about the people, isn't it, that you're working with too?
You are absolutely right. And I'm so excited. Well, first of all, to hear that you're starting up, because it's never too late. And actually, entrepreneurs who start businesses later in life often have a lot of advantages that they're not aware of. Whether that's a little more capital, a bit more confidence, a wider network, and also a bit more patience and just a bit more understanding of how the world works. You know, not everything is going to bounce into the right place the first time. But I think as you get older, you just understand that a bit more. You're a bit more accommodating. And you just have a wealth of experience to draw on. I love the fact you've got two co-founders as well, because three is the magic number.
Is three the magic number? That's really exciting, actually.
Statistically speaking, you're most likely to succeed if you're three co-founders.
Really? We all bring very different things to the table. And I think we all view life in a very similar fashion, and also the family balance as well, which is nice. So it's early days, but one day I'll perhaps share it with you over a cup of tea sometime.
Would love that.
You're in London. You touched on the tech board and what you do for that. I mean, we are living in extraordinarily exciting times tech-wise, aren't we? Have we got lot of British talent out there?
Oh my goodness, we have an explosion of talent. Talent everywhere. We have, you know, the world's best universities. We are at the forefront of deep learning, of med tech, health tech, ed tech, green tech, clean tech, you know, you name it. Tech everywhere, every tech. There is so much going on. A lot of the research is being driven by universities and is coming out of universities, not just Oxford, Cambridge, across the country. There are fantastic innovations taking place in universities that are then being spun out into businesses. And you just have people who have seen it happen. I think that's one of the benefits now of being a bit of a more mature tech ecosystem, is there are people coming through who have seen lots of companies exit. And one of my favorite things is working with former unruly's who are now founders. And there's a wonderful company called Byway, which is flight-free travel. And this is set up by Kat Jones, who was an instrumental part of unruly's success. And now she's founded her own company in the middle of a pandemic, of all the crazy things to do, but it's taking off. She's got customers, she's got capital, she's got a fantastic team. And I think that's what's really exciting now. People have got a network to draw upon, and there are experienced serial entrepreneurs coming through to help support, provide the scaffolding, provide advice, and provide the kind of networks that will really help these companies achieve liftoff. Now, with Tech Nation, the interesting thing is scaling the companies. No shortage of talent, no shortage of great ideas in the UK, but where we've historically struggled over the last few years, and I'm pleased to say this is changing now, is in scaling those companies, getting to unicorn status, so billion-pound companies and beyond. And we're seeing now the UK has more unicorns than any other country in Europe by a long way. And new companies are being established and scaled every day. And then also the types of companies that are coming through. They're companies that want to have an impact, companies that want to make a real positive contribution. Oxford Nanopore is a great example. Spun out of Oxford University, brilliant CEO. It's been absolutely critical during the pandemic. It's a portable DNA sequencer, portable, affordable DNA and RNA sequencing. And wow, watching that come of age. And at some point soon, that will be listing, hopefully, on the London Stock Exchange. So you see how these companies very quickly, you know, within the space of a few years, are able to go from startup to scale up to listing. And that kind of journey is just tremendous to see and gives me real confidence for the future of the UK tech ecosystem.
And what do you think to the speed and pace we're moving, Sarah, in the tech world? I mean, I'm usually slightly behind, you know, I'm always quite a lot behind, actually. I'm still the one that has a handwritten diary as opposed to one on my phone. But, you know, we're seeing extraordinary things happen in the tech world, aren't we? Drones flying medical supplies to remote islands in Scotland and all sorts of things. Do you get frightened by the speed at which everything's changing and how tech we're becoming, or do you really embrace it it and think it's really exciting?
So I've spent enough time in a tech company to know that the best solution is normally the simplest solution. And that isn't always technology. Technology is brittle. Technology complicates. There might be multiple interfaces. There are certainly multiple operating systems. People will struggle to install it, to maintain it, to use it. So I don't think that technology is the answer. I think technology, though, is a very powerful tool that can help address many of the problems that we're facing. Probably the best way of explaining how I feel about it is to tell you about the charities that I support. So one of those is Anna Freud, which is the Centre for Children's Mental Health and Family Wellbeing. And I do worry that all the time we spend with technology, on social media in particular, is harming our mental health. And that's something I think isn't new news. We've known this for a long time. And we could see this at Unruly very early on. We could see how much time people were spending on videos. And we could see that the videos that were generating the most interest and discussion were often not the positive emotional videos, all about personal triumph, but actually very negative videos that stirred up anger, that stirred up anxiety and fear. And digital media has kind of grown on the back of content that is very emotive and negative, polarizing. And that's not good for anyone's mental health. So I think the Anna Freud Center has done a fabulous job of training psychologists, of working with children, working with schools, making sure that they have good habits and that their families and their teachers are aware of some of the red flags to look out for is important. And then there's another charity called Foxglove, and that campaigns against digital discrimination, campaigns against unethical AIs that discriminate against people on the basis of race or gender. And I also think that's an area that we are going to become increasingly concerned with. We need to make sure that as AIs and artificial intelligence becomes responsible for more decision making, we're not building in and compounding stereotypes and prejudices and unconscious biases that already exist in our society. One of the best ways of sorting this, of course, is by getting a more diverse tech community, having more women founding tech companies, having more people of color, people from all over the place and people from different backgrounds and people who think differently. Just having a much more diverse set of people coming together to build products, develop products, sell products, and generally a more diversified tech ecosystem, I think, is going to be absolutely critical unless we're walking into a tech dystopia.
How do we do that, Sarah? It's so difficult, isn't it? Because that's what we do need, and also more diverse and inclusive at leadership level too. I mean, it's right from the top down, isn't it?
Absolutely. This awful pandemic has been lots more children and lots more girls are now interested in taking on STEM subjects, going into medicine, going into research, scientific research. All the news that we've seen identifying different mutations, you know, whether it's looking after patients or, you know, looking at the virus itself, this has really encouraged a whole new generation of kids coming through from all walks of life to think about different types of careers. So that is encouraging. But in terms of leadership, you're absolutely right. It's critical that it doesn't just kind of surge up from the grassroots and doesn't just come up now through the next generation, but those of us who are already here are doing everything we can to set the right tone and to lift up different people and make sure we have diversity in our boards and in our businesses at the highest level. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote Stepping Up. And I wrote this as I was leaving Unruly. And there were several reasons for writing it. One reason was I just wanted to capture all the kind of wonderful things that I'd learned because they felt so precious. And my memory's never been great. So I knew that I'd forget a lot of it and that other people would forget just, you know, how brilliant they'd been and how much they'd done. And I truly believe that digital leadership is a mindset. It's not a qualification. It's not a number. It's not a particular skill set. It's a mindset. And so many people, given the right situation, given the right role, the right support, the right teammates, and the clarity of mission, are going to be able to lead more effectively and be on that leadership ladder faster than they ever imagined possible.
Let's end on your work as an ambassador for the Prince's Trust, Women Supporting Women programme. I mean, that's also really important and has been really lacking, hasn't it, over the last few decades, really?
I'm a huge champion for female entrepreneurs, and whether that's here in the UK or whether that's elsewhere in the world, it's it's just the most wonderful thing to be able to empower a young woman to set up her own business, because then she has economic independence and she has self-esteem and self-belief. Running your own business can really bring you a sense of freedom, a sense of accomplishment, more than you can imagine. And Prince's Trust has done a brilliant job of making sure those opportunities are afforded to all women, not just women who've had the privilege of a university education or a supportive family, but women who are coming out of the most difficult circumstances. And of course, just as capable of building brilliant businesses.
Well, particularly with mentors as well, like you, who've been there and you've been on that journey and you've made the mistakes, you've risen to challenges, you've come out hugely successful. And I know where you do a lot of speaking. I know that you're out there and you've got your handbook and, you know, all of your messaging is helping lots of other people, which is absolutely fantastic. But what next for you, Sarah? I mean, we're doing a podcast now, but I can actually see you in vision. You're so young, you're so vibrant, you're so full of energy. What else is out there? What else do you want to do?
Well, this is just a brilliant moment for looking around. And once you're in a business, once you're on that journey, once you've committed, there's no looking back and there's no looking out. You know, you're in it and you're focused on the ride and focused on growing that business and making good decisions. And that's rewarding and exciting, but it's going in one direction. What I'm really enjoying at the moment is being part of several boards and being an advisor for several companies and getting a sense of the breadth of opportunity that is out here in the UK and beyond. That in itself is really invigorating. And then good stuff will come. I have got a little bit more zen about this. I feel as though the Unruly journey was remarkable and very lucky, but now it's time just to rebalance, honour the past, spend some time reflecting and appreciating what's happened and the people who made it possible, enjoying the present, so being with my kids a lot more and them setting the agenda and me just kind of tagging along and supporting them where needed and being open to the future. So that's where I'm at. I'm open to the future and I'm so pleased to see so much opportunity out there.
Sarah, I've been absolutely dying to hear your story. You've been a fantastic guest. I feel like I could just carry on talking to you all day, really, but I suppose we better wind it up. But thank you, Sarah. You've been brilliant.
Our total pleasure. And a cup of tea at some point in the future sounds lovely.
Hey, listen, I'll take you up on that. Now, you've been listening to Sarah Wood, OBE, giving us an insight into life as an entrepreneur and also talking about the day that changed her life and her journey for good. Thanks very much for listening today. Don't forget, you can download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or just ask Alexa. I'll be back with another great guest next week, so have a fantastic week. See you then. Bye for now.